Let's go ahead and open to Job chapter 40. We're going to start at verse 1 and review some of the things we saw at the end of last session, just so we've got our context clearly in mind as we move forward. Job is listening in as God is talking now, and that's why it's my favorite part of the entire book, because this is most certainly inspired wording, because it's God himself doing the talking. It's also very much exciting to me because we see some creatures mentioned here that are amazing, and I'll explain that a little bit better as we move forward in these next couple of chapters. All right, so Job is hearing from God. God is quizzing him because Job has earlier said, if God had just come down here as if we were in court together and I could grill him as to why he's doing these things to me that are happening when I haven't done anything wrong, then everything would work out because he would see that he shouldn't be punishing me because I haven't done anything unholy. Now, Job is getting lectured by God because Job made a false assumption in those claims. He is assuming God is doing this stuff to him as punishment, when the fact of the matter is, God's not actively doing these things. It's Satan that's doing them, and it has nothing to do with anything Job has done. It's not a punishment for sin. Which that's a vindication of Job because his friends, his acquaintances, keep accusing him of having done wicked things and that's why he's being punished by God. So God has been asked by Job, come clear all this stuff up with me in a court of law. And God shows up and proceeds to say, all right, I'm here. You want to treat this as some sort of court situation where you accuse me of doing things inappropriately. Before we proceed, Job, let's see what you already know about me and know about the things I've been doing in the world. And so he proceeds to ask Job a bunch of questions, which Job cannot answer because Job is a man. Job was not there at the beginning of creation. Job does not have control over the creation. Job does not understand fully how the creation works, whether in its perfection or in its fallen state. So Job is going to have to shut his mouth. And so chapter 40, verse 1, he who is said to Job, shall the fault finder contend with the Almighty? So the one who wants to bring charges against Shaddai, against the Creator God, he who argues with God, let him answer it. So here's your chance, Job. Grill me. You, first of all, tell me what you understand, and then you can ask me out of your wisdom why I'm doing what's going on right now. Now, Job's response is appropriate. Job answered he who is and said, behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further. So Job, when he comes or has the presence of God come into his life and start going over some of the things that he's already done since the beginning of creation, Job's response is, I'm sorry. I don't understand any of those things. I should have kept my mouth shut, and that's what I'm going to do from here on out. I'm going to just listen as you talk. And that really is the big lesson out of this whole book, is that none of us can demand of God, explain yourself. Explain why things are happening the way they're happening. First of all, God is God, and we have no right to demand that he answer us. And second of all, we are humans with finite minds and finite information available to us, and therefore we don't understand the things that God has already done, let alone have the capability of understanding all of the things that God is doing and will do. The only time that we can hope to understand it is when he explains certain things to us through his word. And so God proceeds further with his conversation with Job by reminding him again, you're not God. So he who is answered Job out of the whirlwind. That's the visible presence of God. It's the cloud and the fire that we see in the time of the Exodus and the time of Ezekiel. And even Day of Pentecost, which is coming up, next week, I believe, is going to be Pentecost, when the fire appeared and divided itself up on the 12 apostles. That's some sort of form of the Shekinah glory of God. So verse number 6, then he who is answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, dress for action like a man. I will question you. You will make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? So Job, are you going to bring charges against me? Because you're positive that you know what should be happening here. Verse 9, have you an arm like God? Can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. So do you have your own whirlwind? You know, do you have your own Shekinah glory? Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. So Job, do you have the ability to bring people to judgment? Physically, bring them to death, physical death. And then, as a follow-up, bring them to judgment in the world to come, that is, in life after death? Is that within your wheelhouse? Is that in your repertoire of abilities? Verse 14, then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. So Job, if you have all of that capability, then and only then will I acknowledge you as my peer and be willing to explain myself to you. And of course, that is not the case. Verse number 15 is the introduction of the first of two animals that Job was familiar with, which God presents as amazing, as something beyond the capability of humans to really understand and control. And so I believe, and I'm going to just throw it out here at the very beginning, along with other creation believers, that we are going to see described here two types of what we call dinosaurs today. One is a land-based one. The other one is probably a seawater or ocean-based one. They still were moving around in the Middle East at this time. They may have been rare already, but they have since then gone pretty much extinct, and probably for much the same reason that animals go extinct even today, and that is a change in their habitat, which makes it not suitable to them anymore, and also a change in humankind's interaction with them, sometimes hunting them to extinction. All right, so if you are curious about more of the idea of dinosaurs living in the same time as man. I would recommend places like Answers in Genesis, AIG.org, I believe, is their website, or perhaps the Creation Institute, the Creation Research Institute, CRI.org, that's out in California, because both of those give good presentations as how we've got historical recollection of dinosaur creatures in ancient periods of time. All right, so verse number 15. Behold Behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Now, Behemoth is a Hebrew word. And so our English Bibles tend to just give that as the presentation rather than try to assign a modern-day name or equivalent name to this animal. However, a lot of English versions will put footnotes here and will give a guess as to what this animal is. And one of the ones that frustrates me the most is the one that assumes this is the hippopotamus. And here's the reason they do it, folks. They make the claim that the Hebrew word behemoth is borrowed from a similar sounding Egyptian word, pehemenu, or something like that. It's similar in sound, but it's not exact. And that is the word in Egyptian for ox of the river, and their designation for what we call hippopotamus, which is a Greek word, by the way. Hippopotamus means horse of the river. So they are making an assumption here that the Hebrews borrowed the word from the Egyptians, and all that's meant is the hippopotamus. As we move forward, though, it becomes clear this is not the hippopotamus. It is not a physical description of a hippopotamus. The Greek Old Testament does not use the word hippopotamus, even though it is a Greek word. They instead simply use the word for animal, because the Jewish scholars writing in the 3rd century BC did not have a description in the Greek language that would identify what animal is being talked about here, because they were no longer familiar with this animal. All right, so let's talk about Behemoth. So God made Behemoth just like he made people. Behemoth is a vegetarian. He eats grass like an ox. Verse 16, behold, his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. So he's got very, very strong underpinnings from his hips all the way forward in his chest region, his thoracic region, is very muscly. Verse number 17, he makes his tail stiff like a cedar, and the sinews of his thighs are knit together. Now, the makes his tail stiff like a cedar is not quite the wording here. It's he bends or uses his tail like a cedar. And what's being thought of here is his tail is like a great big monstrous tree. That is not a hippopotamus. If you've seen a hippopotamus tail, it might be like a man's arm, but it ain't like a big cedar tree. And when these guys thought of cedar trees, they tended to think cedars of Lebanon. And when we think of cedars of Lebanon, you should probably think of sequoias. You should think redwoods. So this animal has a great big monstrous tree-like tail with heavy-duty thigh muscles, belly muscles, chest muscles that go along with such a great big tail. Now, immediately, in my mind, I see something like one of the big quadruped animals with the dinosaurs with the great big long neck and the long tail. I think they're called theropods as a larger group. Verse 18, his bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. So the description here is got very, very strong bones and strong limbs. But when it says here tubes of bronze, it makes me wonder whether or not Job would have been aware that these great big creatures have lightweight, hollow bones, which would have allowed them to not be as massive in body weight as we might assume, but yet they would still be very, very strong. We have, for example, birds that have very strong bones, very strong limbs, and yet they are more lightweight because they're not solid bones through and through. Verse 19, I think, takes away the idea again that this is either a hippopotamus or an elephant. I think I've seen that described as well. He is the first of the works of God. So he is premier among the works of God. He is far above all the other animals, if you want to consider him. And that most certainly would describe some of these great big, long-necked, long-tailed, huge, four-footed dinosaurs that have long gone extinct now. Let him who made him bring near his sword, or let his maker bring near his sword, meaning God himself is the only one that could really take this animal down. It is interesting what the Greek Old Testament says at this point. It is basically that he is the pet of the angels. He is a plaything for the angels alone. Meaning, humans need to steer clear because he is not going to be something they can control. Verse 20, for the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. So now we find out he's kind of a marsh dweller. He likes to get down into the water and eat the plants that are there by the edge of the water or in the water itself. Verse 22, for his shade the lotus trees cover him, the willows of the brook surround him. Behold, if the water is turbulent, he's not frightened. He is confident, though Jordan rushes against his mouth. And this is where we find out the Jordan River is within Job's field of reference. He knows the Jordan River. He knows when flood stage hits. It is very swift. It has some major currents. Apparently, at this time period, the Jordan River had some marshy areas next to it that this particular creature must have lived in. And it didn't worry if the Jordan was at flood stage because of its bulk, because of its huge size. Verse 24, can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? So can you grab him and keep him as a pet, put something through his nose to lead him on a rope? No. He is not some sort of ox that you can put a ring in his nose and a rope on the ring and lead him wherever you want to go. This thing is monstrous and the premier example of land creatures made by God. And what Job is supposed to take from that is, God is God. If you, Job, can't take on Behemoth and control him, what makes you think that you can bring God into a court of law and make him explain things to you? Chapter 49, let's shift to another creature. Chapter 41, verse 1, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook? Now, the word Leviathan, I know the V is in our English. It represents actually kind of more of a W sound in Hebrew. But the Hebrew word has the idea of segmentation or lengthening of a segmentation animal. It's used for, I think, serpents might have in mind in some of the passages. But here, it's clearly an ocean-going creature that is long and segmented. So the question of Job is, can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? So can you capture him and make him into a pet? You know, put a bridle in his mouth and hold his tongue down? Can you stick that cord through his nose and lead him around? Can you maybe put some sort of ring through his jaw so that you can control him that way? And all of these are rhetorical, answered with no, you cannot. Now, some of your Bibles, your English Bibles, are going to claim that Leviathan is the crocodile. And the answer is no, it's not. The Greek language has a word for crocodile, and that is not this used in the Greek Old Testament. It's actually the word drakon, as in dragon, as in a great big reptile-like critter. And so this is a sea dragon that's being described here. And we know that ancient peoples did hunt and kill and eat crocodiles. So they could take these creatures on. This creature, God is presenting as somebody that you don't try to take on. Verse 3. Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Will you give him on a leash for your girls? So these are all rhetorical, and the answer is always no. So do you think Leviathan is some sort of pet that you'd give to your little girls to lead down the street? Would he beg and plead with you, oh, please don't kill me. Please just make me a pet for your girls. No, he is a monster of a creature. Verse 6, will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? No, he is not something that is on the open market because he is too big and too vicious to take. Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? The answers to those questions, if you're talking about with crocodiles, is yes, you can. The ancient peoples killed some very large crocodiles, but not this thing. Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. So you might try, but you'll be sorry. And you, if you survive the experience, will never try it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. So even seeing one of these things is scary. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. So God's comment to Job is, I'm the one that made Leviathan. And if every human on the planet is afraid to tackle him, who among mankind actually thinks that they can make the creator of Leviathan answer questions in court? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shields, shut up closely as with a seal. So it sounds like some sort of reptile with scales. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Now, that might be poetic, but it might also be real. You know, there's a lot of stories about fire-breathing dragons. And immediately you go, oh, that's just mythology. Is it? Could there be a mechanism in the skull of an animal to allow it to mix two chemicals to force out into a combustible area fire? The bombardier beetle has something like that, where it has compartments of two inert materials or elements that it mixes together and shoots it out, and it's a defense mechanism. So it's not that hard to scale it up to a huge sea creature. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes forth from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. So I think you can appreciate, since we're going to have to close up here in a moment, God saying, you see this creature? He is majestic. He is amazing. He is scary. Guess what? I'm the one that made him. So if you do not understand him and are not going to try to take him into your control, you should not be trying to force me into your little box of understanding.